Hello and welcome to the Beyond Shakespeare podcast. I'm your host, Robert Crichton, General Overseer of the Beyond Shakespeare podcast, which specialises in creating full cast audio adaptations of drama from before 1642, as well as providing background and other production resources. You can support our work and get a say into what we produce by becoming a patron today. Go to www.patreon.com/ Beyond Shakespeare. And I know all podcasts go on a bit about their patron page and all the rest of it, but now is actually a really good time to join because we're just opening voting for the tail end of the summer season. We need another play to do, and your vote counts. So join today and vote for a play you want us to produce. Anyway, today I'm talking with Christopher Hapke of Groundling Press about producing ebook and print-on-demand reading acting texts of underrepresented plays. The Groundling Press have produced e-editions of Mankind, The Life and Death of Jack Straw, and many, many others we'll hear about shortly. But this episode we will be focusing on Jack Straw, which Beyond Shakespeare is producing in the new year, and I'm really enjoying the prep work for. This was recorded actually almost 2 months ago. It's been a while in the edit. There were a few technical problems with the recording that has taken me a while to tidy up. We actually talked for an incredibly long time, so this is very much a cut down version focusing on the life and death of Jack Straw and the Groundling Press itself and the concept behind it. Though there is more material which may be released in the future. We start by talking about what is the Groundling Press.
Tell us all about it.
Well, Groundling Press is a project I started a few years back now. It actually grew out of some frustration I had with the state of ebooks. I'm a person who has always ended up with more books than I have room for. And also, I've been involved in technology for a long time. I worked in Silicon Valley for a while. So ebooks sounded like a wonderful solution to me when they started becoming ready for prime time. And these days, I read a lot of things on a Kindle or another kind of e-reader. And the one thing I've never been able to do that with was plays. When e-readers were designed, the technology in an e-reader is not very complicated, really. In terms of hardware, but the software that an e-reader uses is really what's made it take off the way it has now. And the problem is that the software is really designed for reading fiction, for reading novels where you have a chapter title and you have a chapter name and then you have blocks of prose paragraphs. And once you go past that, once you get anything else added into the mix, it becomes more difficult. It's not that you can't do it, and some people do it very well, but it's not what it's designed for, and you have to massage it a little. So almost any public domain novel, you can get a good cheap ebook edition, or free in most cases, ebook edition. But when you have something like poetry, especially long-form poetry, or verse, or any kind of script, play script, you can't just grab it, dump it in. And so I was getting frustrated because there were a lot of things I wanted to read that just weren't available in that format. And I thought, maybe I'll just poke at that and see how hard would this be? What can I do about it? And the project kind of grew from that. And what I do is I take early English plays. I'm a little less well-defined than Beyond Shakespeare. I go all the way to the 18th century in some cases and things I have underway. I take original old spelling editions, and that's really the other thing that's helped me get off the ground is that there are now so many publicly available facsimiles, scans, online editions of old plays. So I take the original editions, I clean them up, and I really focus on what I wanted. In a way, these are things that I wanted to exist.
Yes.
My focus.
I absolutely understand that feeling of wanting things to exist that don't exist in the world. I mean, you know, there's hundreds and hundreds of plays which you can't get a version of. You know, they're not done, and it annoys me. And it's exactly that same feeling. You can't...
It is easier to get the written plays, but usually there's some sort of barrier there, too. It's either in a facsimile edition, in some cases, manuscript facsimile, which is the worst possible way to read a play. And when it is in a modern printed edition, often it's an edition designed for academics who are studying the play. So my goal is to make basically reading editions, reading and hopefully at some point performing editions.
I was going to ask, do you know if anyone's used any of your editions for productions? Have there been bulk buys that obviously look to match the sort of cast size?
Not yet. I'm looking at reading editions, really. Something that is, first of all, for practical reasons, I'm not an academic. Mm. I studied Anglo-Saxon and Middle English as an undergraduate, so I'm not coming at this blind, but I'm not I don't have a doctorate in English literature. I'm not looking for, I don't include those very detailed descriptions of what I've changed and how I've modernized things. If there's something ambiguous, and I know it's ambiguous, I'll drop a note in. Yeah. And I'm sure there are, in some cases, places that I may miss something. Every editor misses something.
Yeah.
In fact, in one of my plays, I found an error that I think all the previous editors had missed.
Yes. Is this Jack Straw?
That's the Jack Straw one. We've talked about that.
Well, I mean, let's talk about Jack Straw now, as it's on my list of plays to do. Your thoughts on the play as a reader and as an editor?
Jack Straw is a very interesting play. One of my goals in choosing the plays is plays that I'm not familiar with. I don't have everything at my fingertips. And Jack Straw seemed like a good candidate. It's a short play, for one thing.
It's a very short play. It's got, the large scale of a history play, and yet it's shorter than some of the interludes I've been doing recently. It's incredibly short. It's, 8,500 words?
Yes, I had a problem with it at first. This was actually the first play that I published. It is a very straightforward play in a lot of ways. It's a fun play. It has some very enjoyable scenes, but it's not a play that rewards deep contemplation necessarily. It's a play that can be enjoyed in a very straightforward manner.
Yeah, it's a bit of a romp, really. A lot of it, isn't it? Is romp the right word? It's a sort of action.
Sort of a summer movie, summer blockbuster of plays, rather than the Oscar contender.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've only just started sort of wrangling with the text now to start really understanding how it works, because that's one of the problems I have, is that reading a play is one thing. Actually then getting the actors to say the lines, you suddenly find either more depths or considerably fewer, of which I will be able to report more on shortly.
I look forward to it. That's an area I don't generally have to get into unless there's something like Mankind where I have to figure out, okay, if this is meant to be at least nominally a performing edition, I have to figure out what do we do about the great big missing page in the middle of the play.
Yeah. So what was your solution, or what did you suggest?
I added a short speech and a long footnote, essentially. I made it clear this is a missing page. This is the shortest possible speech that I felt I could write, not trying to be, cod medieval, but clearly we know in Mankind at that point in the play, one character leaves and the other character is reacting to something that's just been said. And so I put in a farewell speech for, it's Mischief, I believe, isn't it?
Yes, it's that you've got the sort of official prologue figure and he's just coming in and annoying him. And it's that sort of thing. Eventually he manages to get rid of him, and then you get the other three coming in at this immediately after. I think that's off the top of my head. That was seemed, I think, accurate.
So Mercy and Mischief are speaking, and then we're missing probably both sides of a leaf, and then new guys nowadays and Nod are on stage and they're talking about how they were summoned. So I added nine lines, one possible interpretation that where Mercy says, happens to mention these concepts, and Mischief says, aha, now I'm going to go and I'll leave you with my friends. And then there's a beginning of it starts in the middle of a line, essentially the next scene. So I write the first half of it, but not in any way trying to be comprehensive, but if you wanted to, you could do it that way. And if you want to read over, if you're reading over the text and not really paying attention to the footnotes, you'll see some brackets in the text and you'll ignore them and it'll still read like a play. I should say, I've talked about the ebook editions. I do also publish at once, going back to just sort of the concept of the Groundling Press. Once I had this text for Jack Straw, I realized that I would enjoy the ebook editions, but I know that I also miss the old Globe Quartos. Mm. I don't know if you remember those.
Yes.
For anyone who doesn't, it's the Shakespeare's Globe, I think, is the official name of the Recreation Theater there in London. They published for a number of years these lovely little editions, reading editions of plays. I enjoyed those, and they were plays that weren't available anywhere else. And I thought, you know, I can do the ebooks. I've managed the formatting, and I've tagged everything and created my style sheets and everything else, and I can move this over. I have the background in editing and publishing. Set it up as a print-on-demand printed edition. So I do have print editions of the plays. Also, that also caused a problem with Jack Straw, which was my first one, because it is such a short play, and there is a minimum size for the print edition. But I really wanted to have one, and I didn't want to have to wait and pair it with another play. So what I ended up doing was adding appendices. I added bits from Walsingham, bits from Froissart, a little bit from Dickens's Child's History of England, just giving the background on the views of the Peasants' Revolt and the way it's been through the years. And I've actually really enjoyed working on those appendices in the later plays.
Obviously, looking on your website, and it was what I really liked was the phrase useful, readable, and affordable, which I just think is an extremely good mission statement for this kind of work, because it's trying to introduce people in an easy way to things that they won't have heard of before. I mean, your list is excellent. I mean, Life and Death of Jack Straw, the Weeding of Covent Garden, which I don't have an edition of, I have to say, Christian Turn Turk, which I do know, and Mankind. And it's such an eclectic selection. And it's lovely that there are easy, accessible routes.
I try to stick with plays where there isn't a super accessible edition, where everything is, 19th century or out of print. I know there is one other edition of A Christian Turned Turk, but it's as part of a collection of early plays about piracy, I think. I don't remember. It's in my bibliography. Mm. But there isn't something where you can just go down and say, yes, I'd like to read that. I'll, pay a couple dollars to download on the e-reader or get the cheap paperback and do that. The eclecticism is very much by design. I've actually got a spreadsheet of potential plays. As I said, it's a slow process, so there are many more plays on my spreadsheet, I'm sure, than I will ever get to. But
yes, there is. I similarly have the question of how far will I get through this before death? I mean, my spreadsheet's is sort of wider but also narrower. So I finish at 1642. But what is a play is a much wider. I have a much wider definition. Anything that looks and acts a bit like drama sort of gets a look in. So it's sort of this terrifying, never-ending list that started off at a few hundred and sort of it's past the 1,000 mark now.
that's the other thing I've been working on kind of as a sideline is that's sort of grown out of this list is just the research I'm doing into the plays I've been putting together into what I call the Groundling List. And if you look on the website, you'll see it's really just a list of every play, extant, lost, and just trying to collate them and look into modern scholarship and see what's come forward and what's lost and looking back at primary sources where I can. And the goal is eventually to have as comprehensive a list as we can of everything that's out there. Right now there are, I think, 1,076 plays by 259 playwrights.
And that's from that's to the 18th century, is it?
Yes, it's to every playwright who wrote something before 1700, I believe.
It's that question of where do you put the cutoff point? I mean, I arbitrarily went with the theatres closed in 1642. That'll do, but even that is pretty arbitrary because that's not to say theatre stopped by any stretch of the imagination. Looking at the layout of your scripts, well, it is they are usable. You've got room to write notes and everything. And
yes, I try to footnote anything that doesn't have a modern reading. I have a slightly different perspective than a lot of editors just coming as an American reading the plays. I am one step further removed from the language that is being used in a sense in both directions. There are some older terms that have survived here that have died out since in Britain and vice versa. But I try to think if somebody is a good fluent English reader, I'm going to footnote anything that you're never going to see in a newspaper or a modern novel so that it is accessible to anyone who wants to read it, that you don't have to be, you know, beyond a thou and a shouldst. For the editor, it's easier even in the earlier plays. In Mankind, there are a series of very local references, and it's easier for an editor to say, we don't know who these people were. You don't need to worry about it. They were local people. They were probably in the audience, and they wrote their names into the play when they performed in this little East Anglian town to get a laugh out of people. Whereas, as an editor, I kind of feel like if there's a reference to a politician, I have to hunt that down and I have to figure out what the political issue was, and I have to write a, you know, three paragraph footnote explaining the particular tariff controversy, and then I go back and delete it and I just have a one sentence saying contemporary politician tariff controversy.
I mean, the thing is with a reference to, say, someone in the audience or that kind of joke, you know what the joke is even if you don't know who that person is.
Yes.
Whereas with the more nuanced political one, it's like mentioning Enron, you know,
right,
today. We'd know that today, but I imagine in a few hundred years' time, you wouldn't know what that reference to. Now, you might then decide in production to swap that with something else, you know, a modern version, and that's the producer's almost prerogative, actually, how they decide to do the plays. And I'm quite conservative in how I do a lot of what I do, with the aim that the next person gets to play around more. I try to keep as much of the original text as I possibly can, unless something goes horribly, horribly wrong.
Yes, it's always easier when I can drop a footnote in.
Yes.
It's harder to put a footnote in an audio drama, obviously. That's one advantage I definitely have, is it's a lot easier to give context in print.
Yes.
And even if people don't read the introductions, you can always drop a footnote.
Yes. Yes. Any thoughts about Jack Straw for me?
Oh, yeah, we didn't really get into this whole odd little bit. Yeah, the Jack Straw's an odd play. It's a very straightforward play, and there's this one part in the text where you have a strange kind of modern metatextual moment, and it's Nobbs, who is your fool. He suddenly, you know, breaks the fourth wall in a very period way. He turns to the audience and he waggles his ears and he says, oh, look at these jokers. But what he's actually saying is, oh, you heard this stupid thing these people said about how, oh, they're going to die for their beliefs. Well, they may die, but I'm going to follow them and I'm going to make some money out of it. And it's a lovely little comic aside, and it fits the character, and it's broad in the way that the play is broad. The odd part is that the line he's referring to specifically, where he says, what are these people to? You hear them say, they owe God a death and they will die. That line is actually attributed to him in the play. So he's making fun of the thing he's said. And I went looking for information because it didn't make sense to me. I was trying to figure out, how do I footnote this? How do I explain this to an audience? And really, the only thing that made sense to me was that it's not actually his line. It's a printer's error. And when I went looking for that, it suddenly became very obvious that it was a printer's error. There's an oath that he uses at the beginning of that speech, and the only other person in the play who uses that oath is a Wat Tyler. And it's kind of in Wat Tyler's register, that sort of blustery character he has in the play. And also, looking back at the scene, it's the big conspirator scene where they all say, are we really going to do this? Are we going to march and start our rebellion? Jack Straw says, yes, I'm going to do that. And John Ball says, yes, I'm going to do that. And Wat Tyler doesn't say a word in the whole scene, essentially. He's there. He has one or two little things, but he doesn't have his big moment of, and this is his big moment. This is his big moment where he says, we owe God a death and we can but die, as I recall. And once I considered the possibility, it seemed like the only obvious choice. And it's,
what's interesting is, because it's so short, is how did it end up being? Was it designed to be that short? Has it been cut? Mm-hmm. What was the context? I mean, what always interests me is people often say, you know, oh, this play has obviously been cut for a paper, perhaps a tour, you know, and it's therefore not as good. And one of my thinking with this is,
Well, yeah. Have you ever been in a play where it doesn't work in the first run and then you just start cutting bits? And, you know, sometimes the cut down version's so much better. In that sense, one of the things I want to know with this is, okay, maybe this is a cut down version of the play, but maybe there's a good reason for that. It's just better. I mean, Jack's Straw is excessively short because it's going to be a struggle to get it over an hour. It might go over an hour, but I don't think it will.
And it runs along. It's very
fast. It moves with pace. There's very little introspection. And I mean, in many ways, with Jack Straw, I'm working on at the moment is more the sound design. You know, how are these scenes going to flow into each other? What because there's certain physical business which is a bit odd.
Yeah,
there's a goose, isn't there?
How do you record someone chasing a mob to hunt down Dutchmen and kill them?
That's easy to record. That's great fun. Doing crowd Foley is possibly one of the most surreal and random parts of my job, which I absolutely love. Just getting random people to run up and down streets going ah, brandishing pitchforks. You know, originally it's published with, I think it's just acts.
Yes.
There's no scene division, but even then, deciding how I treat the scenes and where scene division lives and how that functions, because there's sort of people go out and come back on again and sort of going, well, the scene obviously continues sort of, but has time passed? Has something been cut here? You know, in that producer's head thing of trying to figure out what do I do with this text?
But yeah, I had the same thing where it's, well, do I just do it as, you know, French scenes where any time the personnel changes and that's its own mess. And I had to spend some time on that with Jack Straw as well.
Mm. It's less of an issue for me because all I need to do is produce a formatted script that actors can use and sort of make notes about sound effects. But I work quite holistically with these things. So it's not like you get everyone together in a room at the same time and you have to get everything recorded and everything and all the sound effects and do it all in one go. It's more you bring some people in, work on it, start a rough edit, does that work, bring people back in again, and you can sort of move it around a bit. The bigger the plays, the more cast, the less of that I can do. I mean, it's been quite good with, you know, when you're working with two other people on
it's
a three-hander. It's easy to schedule, but it's also you can work together as a group to decide what you're doing with the play and figure out, you know. It's like with none of the John Haywards, I didn't go in and say, right, this one's going to be set in a pub. This one's going to be, they'll be outside and then they'll go inside and have, you know. We didn't decide any of that in advance. We just sort of sat down and said, well, where do people have these conversations? I mean, it's with Jack Straw as well, looking at some of the characters going, well, can I, it's not so much doubling them, but can I conflate a couple of, because they come on and sort of, they're there to be taught. There is someone for another character to talk to. They're not necessarily a particularly distinct character. Yeah. So you've got that with.
I'm just looking at my, that's another one I had to build the dramatis personae from scratch, basically. And I'm looking at things like A Gentleman of Usher, The County of Salisbury. Yeah. Well, Salisbury has a bigger part, I guess.
It's a bigger part. It's like there's the bishop that turns up and is going, well, is that distinct character really from the Archbishop? I don't know yet. It might be, it might not. But is my immediate sense is going, well, they're separated quite a lot in the text.
But I only see the Archbishop of Canterbury in my dramatis personae. So either I went with conflating them or I
it's that sort of thing that Jack Straw et al, they're all quite well-defined characters, whereas a lot of those peripheral characters around the King and the Queen Mother are all actually sort of people to talk to. There are a few obviously hotheads and stronger voices in there, but there's a lot there where I might take a few minor liberties. Could you do a sort of roundup, a brief roundup of Groundling Press and the editions and what's to come?
The basic idea of the Groundling Press is affordable editions of early plays for people who want to read them or in some cases perform them. They're all available in ebook editions. They're available print on demand, which means a lovely little paperback. There are always samples online on the Amazon site that you can look at to see what you're getting in advance. We try to publish a range of plays. My goal is 1 to 2 plays a year. So far we have Mankind, which is our medieval representative. The Life and Death of Jack Straw is a history play. The Weeding of Covent Garden is a city comedy, a later comedy, a very interesting example of the genre. And A Christian Turned Turk is our first tragedy. We're also working on a tragic comedy, which I hope to have published later, which is a genre that has been somewhat neglected. I think that's going to be out hopefully later this year, which will be a Double Falsehood. At that point, we'll have published a morality play, a comedy, a tragedy, a history, and a tragic comedy, and we'll start in again with another history probably in the following year. Right now, I'm working on The Valiant Welshman,
mm-hmm. Yes,
which is another very interesting play. Our plays are available. If you go to groundlingpress.com, there are links to buy either ebook or print editions. There's also the Groundling list there, which is certainly a work in progress. So find a play missing. I'll probably get there eventually. Feel free to email me if you like, though.
What I like about this is that it's hopefully inspiring other people to explore and encounter plays they wouldn't normally do in a nice, open, accessible way. And I wish you all the best with it, sir. I wish you all the
Thank
best.
Thank you very much.
And that, I think, ends our formal part of the interview, as it were. And I'd like to thank Christopher Hapke for speaking with me. Coming next, we have two more Robin Hood plays coming almost on top of this podcast. They're coming so thick and fast now that you have to duck to get out of their way. And if you are a patron, then you will also be receiving all the workshops that we've been recording over the year so far. There's about 20 of those coming your way. They will be turned into podcasts eventually, but not yet. So you have to become a patron to hear any of that. More material on its way soon. This has been the Beyond Shakespeare podcast, and I've been Robert Crichton. You can follow us on Twitter at Beyond Shakes. Beyond Shakes. Thank you very much. Right.
Other things on my list, by the way, are
yes.
That I haven't Middleton's Blurt.
Oh, Blurt, Master Constable.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, I haven't read that one in ages.